reaction invokes the infamous word greed. Greed, however, is a relative qualification. Income self-maximization is part of the market system's primary logic, once again. It is a strategic rule of the game with limited rational flexibility. The actual amounts realized are irrelevant. It is very easy to rationalize the need for any amount of money or profit because it translates into future security or future productivity. From those individuals who hoard billions under the pretense that they need it to help the world through philanthropy or even just to help their children, to the large corporations that see their income as more fuel for research and development, there is no end to such greedy rationalization. Unsurprisingly, in response to generic HIV drugs being produced by poor countries, Merck Pharmaceuticals stated, "Research and development-based pharmaceutical companies like Merck simply cannot sustain a situation in which the developed countries alone are expected to bear the cost for essential drugs in both least developed countries and emerging markets." This would seem like a fair statement if one ignored the fact that research and development-based pharmaceutical companies like Merck have and continue to enjoy astronomical profits, far exceeding what would be needed to dramatically slow epidemic disease in the third world. As of 2012, only 6 million of the 24 million infected were receiving HIV treatments in sub-Saharan Africa. For the sake of abstract argument, let's assume the price for a year's treatment is the same as it was around 2001, $1,000 for a generic drug made in India. If we take the number of people untreated, based on the 2012 estimate, 18 million, the cost to cover all infected persons in sub-Saharan Africa per year would be $18 billion. Seems like a lot of money, right? Well, it does, until you realize that in 2012, the pharmaceutical industry spent over $27 billion on marketing and advertising alone. If 66% of that marketing budget were shifted, the HIV crisis in sub-Saharan Africa would be dramatically reduced, with millions of lives saved in the long term. To add insult to injury, the 11 largest drug companies made $711 billion in profit between 2002 and 2012, eclipsing virtually all other sectors. The structural violence of an industry unwilling to forgo a small percentage of industrial profits to save millions of lives adds an increasingly somber tone to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s poverty of the spirit. But once again, this is not so much an issue of greed or even character. It is an issue of system logic, of appropriate, self-maximizing, business-as-usual decision-making. HIV/AIDS in Africa is just one example of the incredible degree of manifest human indifference today. When outrageous wealth and resource inequality on the global level, if equalized even slightly, would save millions of lives every year, reducing vast suffering and destabilization. Moving on and returning to our larger order context of physiological and psychological health issues resulting from low socioeconomic status, let's now explore the micro realm. While the consequences of inequality are extremely severe in the developing world, given the degree of abject poverty, a more subtle and overshadowed level of structural violence is also ubiquitous. We can see this more clearly in the developed world, where across populations we find a clear socioeconomic distribution of disease and mortality. In short, the poorer and further down the socioeconomic ladder you are, the more suffering you endure, and the faster you will die. Statistical evidence of this is particularly clear in wealthy countries with larger income disparities. The United States makes an excellent study, since it has one of the largest income-wealth gaps in the world, along with a workable amount of reported public data. A 2011 study by researchers at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health found that factors surrounding poverty, lack of education, and racial discrimination were linked to the death of approximately 874,000 Americans in 2000. About 2.8 million Americans died in 2000, meaning 31% of the U.S. population died because of these arguably preventable circumstances tied to income and loss of opportunity. Dr. Sandro Galea, the chair of epidemiology at Columbia, states, "Social causes can be linked to death as readily as can pathophysiological and behavioral causes. These findings argue for a broader public health conceptualization of the causes of mortality and an expansive policy approach that considers how social factors can be addressed to improve the health of populations." A 2015 report from the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine found an average lifespan difference of about 13 to 14 years between rich and poor in the U.S. Even worse, the trends actually show stagnating and even declining lifespans for the poor in the past 30 years, with the rich gaining years of life quite rapidly. For example, roughly 6 years have been gained by the richest class of women measured, while the poorest class measured lost about 4 years. This research was corroborated by the Brookings Institute, with its report confirming life expectancy is rising for those at the top of the distribution of individuals ranked by alternative measures of socioeconomic status, but it is stagnant or declining for those at the bottom. A more extreme result exists in the city of London, where the London Health Observatory found a staggering 25-year gap in life expectancy between the rich and poor overall. Today, there is no question that low socioeconomic status is a true risk factor for many mortality-producing diseases. Socioeconomic inequality directly links relative poverty to strokes, cancer, cardiovascular disease, and many other ailments. Dr. Samuel Broder, former director of the National Cancer Institute, declared that poverty is a carcinogen, referring to it as a cancer-causing agent. A 2013 study expanding previous stroke correlations to income confirmed poorer people within a population and poorer countries globally are most affected in terms of incidence and poor outcomes of stroke. Mortality rates and disability-adjusted life years lost have been reported to be up to 3.5-fold higher in low income compared with middle and high income countries. The number of deaths from stroke is projected to increase from 6.5 million in 2015 to 7.8 million in 2030, with a faster increase projected for LMIC, low middle income countries, compared with HIC, high income countries. As for heart disease, the evidence is even stronger that social stratification causes increased mortality. As the leading cause of death on Earth overall, heart disease kills around 17 million people annually. A 2011 study done by UC Davis found that people with lower socioeconomic status had a 50% greater chance of developing heart disease. Using data from the United States, where more than 600,000 deaths occur each year, the lead author of the study concluded, "Low socioeconomic status is a heart disease risk factor on its own and needs to be regarded as such by the medical community." This is an important observation. It essentially states that the intersecting problems common to the lower class are consistent enough for us to view class itself as a public health detriment. When that view is taken, causality then links directly to the structure of the social system, as explained before. How exactly does inequality translate into such health disparities? There are a range of notable influences. The combination of stress, lack of absolute resources, lack of options, and lifestyle choices are core factors. While it may seem to some that lifestyle and education are unlinked from poverty, the truth is that there is a direct correlation between low socioeconomic status and low educational attainment, along with negative lifestyle choices. Regarding education, Child Fund International, a nonprofit that compiles research on the effects of child poverty, stated, "One of the most disturbing links between poverty and education we see is that low household income correlates closely with poor achievement in school. Children from lower-income families are more likely than students from wealthier backgrounds to have lower test scores, and they are at higher risk of dropping out of school. Those who complete high school are less likely to attend college than students from higher-income families. For some children, the effects of poverty on education present unique challenges in breaking the cycle of generational poverty and reduce their chances of leading rewarding, productive lives. A 2015 Columbia University study found that cognitive impairment correlates to poverty in the form of brain damage. It showed that the brain structure of children and teenagers in poverty actually differs from those in affluent conditions. The largest study of its kind, focusing on areas of the brain related to functions such as language, reading, and decision-making, revealed that children and families earning less than $25,000 a year had 6% less development than those earning $150,000 or more. A similar study also found that poverty overall correlates to a reduction of cognitive capacities and subsequently an effective reduction in IQ. This study, which was done at the University of Warwick, concluded that the stress of worrying about money and survival, clearly common to the lower classes, can create a cognitive deficit equivalent to a loss of 13 IQ points. The researchers suggest that this stress explains why poorer people are more likely to make decisions that exacerbate their financial difficulties. Poor nutrition also strongly correlates to poverty. A 2010 study confirmed the obvious, stating, "Many nutritional professionals believe that all Americans, regardless of income, have access to a nutritious diet. In reality, food prices pose a significant barrier for many consumers who are trying to balance good nutrition with affordability." The nutritional deficits, obesity, and other physical and mental health consequences associated with poor nutrition are not simply lifestyle choices, but at least in part, a consequence of the limited access to nutrition available to people with little money living in low-income neighborhoods. When I lived in Bushwick, Brooklyn some years ago, I witnessed this phenomenon firsthand. I was residing in an illegally converted commercial loft, a common feature of West Brooklyn in those days. My neighborhood had a cliché gangland feel reminiscent of a Charles Bronson movie. While it has improved a bit today, this pre-gentrified area was an echo of 1980s New York City poverty, with steel bars on everything and store clerks hiding behind bulletproof glass. My apartment building, a converted factory, was surrounded by a steel gate that rose 30 feet in the air, making it look more like a prison. Right next door was the local grocery store, which I frequented. As a glaring white anomaly roaming the aisles among the predominantly poor Black and Hispanic customers, I came to realize that not only did many of my neighbors pay for their food with food stamps, but they also appeared to pretty much live on cheap ramen noodles, frozen pizzas, Coca-Cola, and other high-sugar, high-sodium, and high-fat processed foods. In 2014, the nonprofit group Feeding America surveyed 60,000 people who use such food subsidy programs, finding that 80% tended to buy junk food to further save money. They also found an expected yet startling disproportional occurrence of diabetes and high blood pressure. This problem is compounded, they noted, by the larger order problems such as how stores in poor neighborhoods tend to stock low-quality food over more expensive, healthful food, further reducing choice. This is to be expected, since in a market economy, product quality is associated with purchasing demographics. Just as a company will make a very expensive car to target the rich, food companies produce low-quality, unhealthful, preservative-polluted food to sell to the poor. However, when you have little purchasing power, the nutritional content of a food becomes secondary to the desperate interest in saving money, coupled with the aforementioned educational limitations inherent in poverty. People cannot be expected to purchase more healthful food that is also more expensive when they lack the means to afford it, and when they may also be ignorant of the health problems that lower quality food can cause. Regarding psychological stress, an interesting nutrition-related case study is the phenomenon of poverty-driven obesity in the first world. Astoundingly, it has been projected by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, that 42% of Americans will be obese by 2030. In the work Stress Science, Neuroendocrinology, by neuroscience and mental health expert George Fink, powerful research on the adverse effects of emotional stress on the human body is explored in great detail. The work states, many overweight people, particularly those with abnormal obesity, find that eating increases in situations of discomfort and also soothes their feelings of stress and anxiety. This phenomenon is usually called stress eating or emotional eating. While obese individuals may realize that in general they eat in response to stress emotions, they are typically unable in the moment to stop themselves from eating. This type of stress eating might be due to disruptions of central regulatory systems involved in the control of energy intake. In obese binge eaters, stress eating occurs and it is up to 100% specifically triggered by stress and negative moods, for example, depression, anger, anxiety, etc. As is also the case with compulsive drug or alcohol use, stress eating as self-medication can find its root in immediate conditions, as a result of prior life trauma, or both. A 2014 Swedish study examining 112,000 participants found a well-defined link between child abuse and adult obesity. It states, the study clearly shows that difficult life events leave traces which can manifest as disease much later in life. The mechanisms behind this process include stress, negative patterns of thought and emotions, poor mental health, increased inflammation, as well as lowered immune function and metabolism. Now, one may counter-argue that incurred physical, emotional, and sexual abuse in childhood has nothing to do with the later adult's socioeconomic status, and hence class cannot be blamed. However, this argument holds little ground since the precondition of poverty is arguably the largest broad predictor of physical, emotional, and sexual abuse in childhood. When exactly this socioeconomically triggered causality occurs in life doesn't change its relevance. There are also unique biological synergies that make matters worse, wherein stressed, possibly predisposed people not only eat too much, but also will naturally crave foods containing high levels of salts and sugars. When the brain is stressed, it releases certain stress hormones. These hormones push and pull on one's system, with the body often seeking alleviation. One outlet is an increase in dopamine. Dopamine, a powerful neurotransmitter, gives a sense of pleasure when released. Sugars, salts, and fats are known to trigger a dopamine response over other foods, which is why people gravitate toward comfort foods, especially when stressed. A 2008 study undertaken with genetically altered mice also showed that stress contributes to increased consumption of food high in fat and carbohydrates, and could possibly increase the risk of obesity. Overall, in the developed world, the highest rates of obesity occur among population groups with the highest poverty rates and the least education. However, it is worth pointing out that obesity is unique in its biopsychosocial causality, since body image stigma, loss of confidence, and hence reduced perceived social status can create a vicious feedback loop. The depression and anxiety common to people already overweight or obese is exacerbated by the stress of poverty, lack of options, and feelings of low self-worth. This stress then triggers the biological urge to further overeat often unhealthful yet satisfying high-risk factor foods, repeating the cycle. Now, while more specific mental health issues will be touched upon, notably psychiatric disorders and the psychology of behavioral violence, it is important to highlight that in the field of epidemiology, what used to appear as only physiological has come to be understood as often equally psychological. The truth is there is actually no singularly physiological or singularly psychological phenomenon, just as there is no nature as separate from nurture. Body and mind act in synergy. After all, regardless of its grand mystique, the brain is still an organ like the heart or liver. What has been discovered is that the effects of emotional stress are no longer mere agitators of already unhealthy states. Negative stress is actually a silent killer. It is a pathogen linked to social inequality, constituting a public health epidemic in and of itself. Psychosocial stress, meaning psychological stress coming from the social environment, links to brain damage, hormone problems, depression, anxiety, reproductive complications, sleep disorders, growth impairment, memory problems, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, gastrointestinal disorders, sexual disorders, and overall immune deficiencies that open the door to a host of other diseases and complications. One of the more studied links is heart disease. Atherosclerosis, a condition in which plaque builds up in the arteries, leading to a heart attack or stroke, has been tied to stress hormones, such as glucocorticoids, which trigger immune processes that lead to plaque deposits in the arteries. Chronically stressed people slowly poison their arteries, ultimately reducing their lifespan. A landmark study started in 1967 by Michael Marmot of the University College of London analyzed more than 17,000 British civil servant workers over 10 years. These were middle-class people representing a more narrow range of socioeconomic stratification. Oriented around job status specifically, or what the study called an employment grade, the study found that the highest and lowest rungs of the group had a threefold difference in cardiac disease mortality. In controlling for various factors, noting that everyone had universal free health care at his or her disposal, the study concluded that psychosocial stress played a prominent role in the outcome. 2 decades later, a follow-up study was done that confirmed the prior findings, expanding to reveal deeper social determinants of disease by way of social stratification. Again, this phenomenon of psychosocial stress is not an issue of poverty or absolute deprivation, but one of perceived relative social status. Marmot states, "What we found in Whitehall was that the lower the grade of employment, the higher the risk of heart disease. But not just heart disease, every major cause of death. And that was a bit shocking. The higher the grade, the better the health. The lower the grade, the higher the mortality rate and the shorter the life expectancy in this remarkably graded phenomenon. The other striking thing is that none of them is poor in the conventional sense. We're used to thinking that poverty is bad for health, and so it is. Poverty is dreadful for health. But even the lowest grades of British civil service are not poor in any absolute sense of the word. It was this gradient. It was not just about poverty." He continues, "So we haven't got the richest people in society, we haven't got the billionaires, and we haven't got the poorest people in society. And we haven't got anybody who's unemployed or has any risk of losing their job. And yet we see this remarkable social gradient. The people at the bottom of the hierarchy had a 4 times higher risk of death than people at the top. The people in the middle had twice the mortality risk of the people at the top, in people who were not exposed to any of the usual hazards." The research showed that psychosocial stress seemed to account for about 75% of the social gradient in mortality. He continues, "We have strong evidence that there are 2 important influences on health in explaining the hierarchy in health. The first is autonomy, control, and empowerment. People who are disempowered, people who don't have autonomy, people who have little control over their lives, are at increased risk of heart disease, increased risk of mental illness, and so on. The second is being able to take your place in society, to benefit from all that society has to offer. It's self-esteem. It's the esteem of others. It's saying that I can benefit from the fruits that society has to offer." The implication is far-reaching. Social inequality is itself problematic. While social status is not necessarily about income, there is no question that income and wealth are signifiers of one's sense of status, belonging, self-respect, and autonomy with regard to society as a whole. In effect, what we have is a public health indictment of the very nature of social stratification itself. Evidence shows, in contrast to propaganda, that humans should endure and embrace primitive, stratified power and oppression. That social class and the inferior-superior relationship inherent in it is simply bad for social and personal health. Hence, capitalism, which is the embodiment of this market-created hierarchy, is really a poisonous social construct. This study, while performed in Britain, has been replicated across the world, with little variation in the overall outcome. Hierarchy simply makes people sick. This is also made worse by the nature of our commercial, consumer society once again, where advertising's functional role is to make people feel inadequate and subordinate. In the words of neuroscientist and stress health expert Robert Sapolsky, it isn't about being poor, it is about feeling poor. As touched upon before, the work of Richard Wilkinson of the University of Nottingham has further explored this phenomenon in great detail, examining differences between countries that have different degrees of economic inequality. While we know that poverty is extremely bad for one's health, so is relative poverty, or relative economic inequality. Research has specifically shown that independent of absolute income, the more income inequality there is in a society, the worse the health and mortality rates are overall. Figure 4B shows aggregated data for a range of developed countries ranked from lowest to highest income inequality and better to worse conditions for the social and health concerns noted on the left side. While the synergy of the mind-body connection to health has been explored broadly, let's now home in on the more traditional mental health concerns. Though there are often genetic predispositions to issues such as depression, anxiety, personality disorders, suicide, and drug addiction, negative stress and life trauma no doubt have powerful causal connections. A great deal of this stress can be directly correlated to economic problems such as job loss, economic decline, status, and so on. Figure 4B illustrates that from Japan to the U.S., there is a worsening of mental illness, drug addiction, obesity, and homicides as economic inequality increases. Once again, while there are absolute deprivation effects that stress people into unhealthy states and patterns, relative deprivation is just as powerful in its own way. Regarding drug and alcohol addiction, the biopsychosocial nature of this issue has become extremely clear in recent times. While the world still imposes primitive legal punishment for people who self-medicate or are addicted to illegal drugs, recognition of the issue as a problem in public health has been steadily growing. Dr. Gabor Mate, a Canadian physician who specializes in the treatment and understanding of addiction, said, "The greatest damage done by neglect, trauma, or emotional loss is not the immediate pain they inflict, but the long-term distortions they induce in the way a developing child will continue to interpret the world and her situation in it. Further, not all addictions are rooted in abuse or trauma, but I do believe they can all be traced to painful experience. The effects of early stress or adverse experiences directly shape both the psychology and the neurobiology of addiction in the brain." It has been historically common to conclude that addiction simply emerges from the repeated use of an addictive substance or activity, coupled with a genetic predisposition. Yet, both conclusions now appear to be secondary when accounting for emotional stress and trauma. These environmental factors take priority. Childhood stress appears particularly defining. One of the largest investigations ever conducted to assess associations between childhood maltreatment and later life health and well-being is called the Adverse Childhood Experiences, ACE, study out of San Diego. Tracking 17,000 participants, it linked severe childhood stress to many adult addictions. It measured a range of stress factors, such as having an incarcerated parent, living in a house with domestic violence, losing a parent to death or divorce, and having a mentally ill or addicted parent, along with emotional, physical, and sexual abuse and neglect. The study applied a calibrated scoring system to factors, considering their mixture. In other words, something like sexual abuse would be considered one type of ACE, while emotional abuse, such as humiliation, would be another. These then would be added together to assess the probability of certain addiction outcomes. The study found a vast range of increased propensities for drug use, such that the more ACEs in play, the higher the probability. For example, a male child with 4 or more ACEs was found to be 7 times more likely to be an alcoholic than a person with no ACEs. In a separate study using the same framework, economic hardship, or an inability to meet financial needs, was also included. Unsurprisingly, economic hardship was deemed the most common adverse childhood experience reported. However, that economic correlation is just one of many. While the study includes economic hardship singularly, which is more often than not linked to low socioeconomic status, the study overlooked how the other ACEs considered, such as child abuse, are also highly correlated to poverty and economic inequality. As far as mental illness overall is concerned, it has been well established that low socioeconomic status is a risk factor. A report published by the American Psychological Association examining a database of 34,000 patients with repeat psychiatric hospitalizations found that unemployment, poverty, and housing unaffordability were correlated with a risk of mental illness. The study states, "One of the most consistently replicated findings in the social sciences has been the negative relationship of socioeconomic status, SES, with mental illness. The lower the SES of an individual is, the higher is his or her risk of mental illness." Similarly, an analysis by M. H. Brenner, covering 120 years of data from New York State mental institutions, found that instabilities in the national economy are the single most important source of fluctuations in mental hospital admissions or admission rates. As far as depression is concerned, a study by researchers at Washington University in St. Louis in 2016 actually found that child poverty can alter brain connectivity, weakening important connections between regions, leading to future clinical depression. Deanna M. Bartsch, Ph.D., chair of Washington University's Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences in Arts and Sciences, stated, "In this study, we found that the way those structures connect with the rest of the brain changes in ways we would consider to be less helpful in regulating emotion and stress. It behooves us to remember that adverse experiences early in life are influencing the development and function of the brain. And if we hope to intervene, we need to do it early so that we can help shift children into the best possible developmental trajectories." Likewise, in a 2014 survey published by the U.S. government's Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, clinical psychologist Bruce E. Levine stated that suicidality, depression, and mental illness are highly correlated with involvement in the criminal justice system, unemployment, and poverty. Given the fact that the lower classes are more prone to experience the criminal justice system, one cannot dismiss the socioeconomic connection to this attribute on its own, reinforcing the broad influence of economic conditions overall. It appears the justice system's imposed restraint of freedom and loss of control helps lead one to such mental illness. A study in Denmark from 2011 found an increased suicide rate not only for people who had been found guilty and incarcerated, but also for those who simply had general exposure to the process, that is, found innocent and set free. The author concludes, "Thus, exposure to the criminal justice system in itself may contribute to elevating a person's suicide risk, rather than simply reflecting the traits and characteristics of people who come into contact with the system." Again, while one may see vulnerability to the criminal justice system as detached from economic forces, systemic reasoning forces the realization that most all crime in the world is property-driven to one degree or another. In other words, if there were no scarcity pressure, no core survival stress or status-shaming inequality, crime would drop dramatically compared with what we endure today. As for suicide, this phenomenon is a profound existential tragedy. It is the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. Approximately 105 Americans commit suicide every day, with an attempt made every 31 seconds. Globally, about 800,000 commit suicide annually, with many more attempts. 75% occur in low- and middle-income countries, with 30% occurring by way of pesticide self-poisoning in recent times. This pesticide self-poisoning has become a powerful pattern in rural regions in the developing world. While part of a larger global pattern of farmer suicides, patterns in the global south have specific characteristics that link it directly to changes in international trade policy and effectively neoliberal globalization. In fact, of all the variations of structural violence we could categorize, the economically induced mass suicides by farmers who have lost their means of survival due to austerity, economic adjustment programs, trade policy, and ultimately the stress of debt have been staggering in number. India is now home to one out of every three suicides worldwide. Between 1997 and 2014, more than 280,000 farmers committed suicide in India. This averages out to roughly 16,000 suicides per year. The most common reason found has to do with debt and crop failure. While crop failure is not necessarily a structural outcome, as poor weather is partly to blame, the vast debt farmers have recently endured creates stress that, in combination, pushes them over the edge. It isn't just the predominantly male death toll that is tragic, it's the desperate families left behind. For every farmer committing suicide, there is almost always a wife with multiple children left in economic and personal despair. Indian journalist Palagumi Sainath, who studied the problem for decades, is one of many who argue the phenomenon is directly tied to the arrival of neoliberal trade liberalization in the 1990s. He states, "Every suicide has a multiplicity of causes. But when you have 300,000 in the same occupation within a compressed period of time, then you want to start looking for the common factors." He concluded, along with many others, that debt is the central driving factor behind the suicides, noting that agricultural costs and interfering foreign subsidies had increased greatly following the implementation of neoliberal agricultural practices. General debate on the issue is wide, with a well-oiled PR machine that has worked to dismiss any assignment of blame to commercial, corporate, or government policy. It's widely speculated that the Indian government underreports the numbers and shifts context to downplay the reality, while large agricultural-related companies such as Monsanto have directly countered and denied any systemic links. The truth is that while the defensive position portrays trade liberalization and the forced introduction of Western patented seeds as having no correlation with the rise and persistence of debt-driven farmer suicide, a detailed analysis proves otherwise. The spread of neoliberal globalization and Western transnational agribusiness to India began by way of World Bank, IMF, structural adjustment policies in the late 1990s. A structural adjustment is a contractual condition for obtaining or restructuring a loan from these international institutions. In most cases, changes to national economic policies must be made. Privatization is one such contractual demand, forcing once nationalized or public services into the hands of private corporations, often with dire consequences. Once again, at the core of neoliberal conception is the theory of self-regulation and total open market competition. I say theory because that is all it is. The truth is that open markets only give advantage to those with the most economic leverage, coupled with endless amounts of government collusion to ensure that leverage. Such is the inevitable paradox of the free market once again. So to be clear, the neoliberal reality actually has little to do with free trade and everything to do with strategic advantage on the part of vested commercial interests that are far too often directly tied to the international lending and trade institutions. Deregulation, trade liberalization, and privatization are political tools used to force open a country's economy, making it vulnerable to profit-seeking interests that otherwise wouldn't be able to interfere. Trade liberalization isn't talked about this way at international economic summits, of course, but that is exactly how things have unfolded for numerous developing nations around the world. In the case of India, the World Bank's structural adjustment policies required the country to open up its seed and overall agricultural sector to transnational corporations like Monsanto. One area of interest was cotton, for which Monsanto had developed a proprietary genetic type. These seeds, generally called BT cotton, cost substantially more than traditional seeds. Also requiring supporting chemicals and monoculture regimens to work properly. These seeds also can't be reproduced, owing to genetic modification, forcing farmers to buy the custom products from Monsanto each season. Before the 1990s, seeds were naturally collected upon harvest and used the next year. The increased expense of this new regimen ultimately led to substantial borrowing under the promise of increased crop yields, diminished pesticide use, and hence more profit. At the same time, adherence to the new trade policies required the gradual removal or reduction of once fortifying Indian government agricultural subsidies, leaving the cotton farmers to compete in the market with little support. Simultaneously, the United States and other nations were now free to export cotton to India and sell it much more cheaply than the Indian farmer ever could. The U.S. in the early 2000s was subsidizing its cotton production by about $18 billion a year, thereby making it very cheap and competitive in the consumer market. Given all this, Indian production was at a massive competitive disadvantage. In the words of Vandana Shiva, "The WTO rules for trade and agriculture are, in essence, rules for dumping. They have allowed wealthy countries to increase agribusiness subsidies, while preventing other countries from protecting their farmers from artificially cheap imported produce. $400 billion in subsidies combined with the forced removal of import restriction is a ready-made recipe for farmer suicide. Global wheat prices have dropped from $216 a ton in 1995 to $133 a ton in 2001. Cotton prices from $98.2 a ton in 1995 to $49.1 a ton in 2001. Soybean prices from $273 a ton in 1995 to $178 a ton. This reduction is due not to a change in productivity, but to an increase in subsidies and an increase in market monopolies controlled by a handful of agribusiness corporations. So, Indian farmers went into debt to buy the new patented products, which reduced their tolerance for crop failure, all while being forced to compete with cheaper, subsidized cotton imports. The structural violence machine accelerated to full speed. Foreign producers earned high profits, Monsanto collected vast seed royalties for its monopoly crop, and Indian cotton farmers spiraled into disarray. A study by Srijit Mishra, a professor at the Mumbai-based Indira Gandhi Institute of Development Research, found that in 2006, 86.5% of farmers who took their own lives were in debt, and about 40% had suffered a crop failure. A 2014 analysis published in Globalization and Health, directly addressing the question of quantitative evidence for the suicides, concluded that the liberalization of the agricultural sector in the early 1990s led to an agrarian crisis, and that consequently, farmers with certain socioeconomic characteristics, cash crops, cultivators, with marginal landholdings and debts, are at particular risk of committing suicide. It found that there is a significant positive relationship between the percentage of marginal farmers and suicide rates, but only when we control for either or both cash crop production and indebted farmers. In other words, a small farmer growing cash crops, which include BT cotton, coupled with being in severe debt, is highly correlated to suicide. The central focus here is psychological stress related to debt. Debt and the mechanisms that have preceded its creation by way of neoliberal globalization and free trade is killing people. Before global intervention in the 1990s, such debt levels did not exist, nor did the level of suicides. Destabilization. Now, to complete this chapter, I will address the second half of the two outcomes at the bottom of Figure 4A. These are reduced social stability and increased behavioral violence. While these outcomes can include issues such as human dispossession from a regional pollution crisis or refugees produced by war, the main focus here is behavioral violence. Most people who hear the term violence simply imagine interpersonal and intergroup conflict. But violence includes self-inflicted acts such as suicide, toxic socioeconomic conditions that cause mental and physical disease, or economic policies that ensure the perpetuation of genocidal outcomes in the Third World. As touched upon in Chapter 1, our social nature guides us to great empathic concern for acts of direct violence, such as person-to-person murder. Murder gets much more attention than more indirect mortality, such as death from heart disease. It is certainly emotionally dramatic to witness a terrorist behead a victim on television, see photos of torture from the Abu Ghraib prison, or to be reminded of the genocidal horrors of World War II. Yet, while these visceral, certainly horrific and heartbreaking events may challenge our humanity and cause deep existential pain, from an objective public health standpoint, they are statistically lower in priority as far as overall unnecessary human suffering and death is concerned. For example, heart disease, which is correlated to low socioeconomic status, is far more of a threat to general public health than behavioral violence. In this way, structural violence challenges our most common intuitions about what is or isn't inflicted harm. However, as expressed by Dr. James Gilligan earlier, the most powerful predictor of the murder rate is the size of the gap in income and wealth between the rich and the poor, and the most powerful predictor of the rate of national or collective violence, war, civil insurrection, and terrorism, is the size of the gap between income and wealth between the rich and poor nations. I reiterate this as it is critical to our conception of interpersonal and group violence. Taking a structuralist perspective of behavioral violence is to take a scientific or public health perspective. No human being suddenly wakes up one day with extremely bigoted or racist views, nor does he or she choose to harm others without reason or by way of some kind of biopsychosocial distortion that pollutes the mind. While it is true that some people are born with strong propensities for sociopathology or psychopathology, statistically, these predispositions do not come close to explaining the vast prevalence of behavioral violence across the world today. As Gilligan points out, while behavioral violence pales in comparison to the deaths caused by structural violence, behavioral violence itself is also an outcome of structural violence. The through line of inequality and deprivation manifests in shame, anger, and psychological distortion. It can occur in something of a novel way during one's life, or it can be an extension of culturally developed bias. There is no doubt cultures of violence have been created around the world, as notably seen with multi-generational terrorism and gang behavior, along with racism and bigotry. This is problematic from a causal perspective, since it is easy to forget that causality for violent propensities can run deeper than a single generation. Loss of opportunity, loss of social inclusion, loss of material support, loss of security, and the life or cultural history of people enduring intersecting inequalities and deprivation, all link to personal and social destabilization. How these outcomes tie back to the competitive market structure is certainly more complex than the prior investigation of health disparities resulting from inequality or loss of economic means. Yet they can be traced. When the smoke clears, we find that the main cause of human conflict and the destabilization it creates links back to economically induced desperation, fear, and contempt. Just as we find that research on interpersonal violence links to poverty, low socioeconomic status, lack of education, and exclusion, we see that the same basic attributes apply to group behavior. At the same time, the logic of the market economy, firmly rooted in competition and exploitation, creates justification for direct acts of state violence through war, along with imperially imposed global trade policies. Neoliberalism is the modern adaptation of state violence, in which Western power uses trade sanctions, embargoes, and austerity to ensure global compliance of nations that are not in line with its economic interests. This tendency is not to be confused with the flaw of state power, as some in modern libertarian circles propose. Rather, this mafia-like behavior is tied to the ethic of market competition at the root. Free trade agreements and the now global laissez-faire obsession systemically create conditions ripe for group violence on many levels. With that overview stated, this section will explore three dominant areas of group violence: hate crime and racism, terrorism and gang violence, and national war. A hate crime is generally defined as a crime motivated by bias against a race, religion, disability, ethnic origin, or sexual orientation. Unlike normal crime, which is usually about property or money directly, the perpetrator of a hate crime is motivated only by the desire to make the victim worse off. As for analysis, the first problem with measuring these events is the lack of reporting. Using the United States as an example, a 2013 study released by the Bureau of Justice Statistics found that only 1 in 3 hate crimes was generally ever reported to law enforcement. Of those reported cases, for the period of 2007 to 2011, the average number of hate crimes was about 259,700 a year. It also found that about 92% of those crimes were of a violent nature. For the same period, 21% were reported as due to religious bias, and 54% due to racial bias. Similar patterns are found around the world to varying degrees, with ideological and ethnic bias also dominant. There is no doubt that the cultural factors involved in generating bigotry are complex. However, as with all human development, there are long-term and short-term causal influences. A common short-term influence is the direct impression made by parents and communities during a person's upbringing. It is commonly understood that religious and racial bias often forms during early development, influenced by parents and peers. While weak biological arguments for innate racial bias have floated around for years, a 2013 study in the Journal of Cognitive Neuroscience found that the part of the brain that is responsible for racial recognition, the amygdala, does not show a response until the age of 14. It also found through neuroimaging scans that the amount of measured activity correlates to the amount of racial diversity experienced in the child's life history. The more racially diverse the peer group, the less strong the amygdala effect, indicating racial sensitivity. This basically means the brain is programmed by the child's exposure. The authors state, "These findings suggest that neurobiases to race are not innate, and that race is a social construction learned over time." Regarding long-term influence, it can be multi-generational or cultural, with bias spreading as something of a thought gene passed down and around over time. This has been touched upon previously with respect to America's white versus black racism, largely attributed to early abject slavery. Again, the notion of racial bias against those of African origin has been well established as artificially cultivated, advertently and inadvertently, through economic interests simply seeking to save money on labor. Over time, as slavery and then Jim Crow segregation faded, the class battle for survival in the capitalist order kept the poor white and black cultures at odds, in the same way the rise of immigration and loss of jobs in the U.S. has been accompanied by bigotry and xenophobia toward Mexicans and other subcultures migrating from the global South. A unique parallel to American racism is India's caste bigotry. In his work, Castes of Mine, Colonialism and the Making of Modern India, Nicholas Dirks explains how the arrival of the British in India changed the nature of ancient class relationships, morphing them during the colonial period into hierarchies for political and economic dominance. The British politically incorporated the existing religious caste structure into a method of social organization and control, dividing ranks and structuring elitism. They basically added new meanings, connotations, and implications to the existing caste system to suit their own colonial needs, in a kind of divide-and-rule approach. Once colonial rule ended, the associations created remained in place, perpetuating caste bias and discrimination to this day. While this may seem vague from a socioeconomic perspective, remember that the purpose of the Indian colony was fundamental for economic exploitation. The drain of wealth, as termed by Dadabhai Nauroji, helped make the British rich through robbing India and exploiting human labor. This links the pursuit of profit and the primary logic of capitalism to such social manipulation and hence the chain reactions still plaguing the country. Today, about 165 million lower caste people are routinely subject to discrimination, exploitation, and violence as a result. Now, as far as hate crime in general goes, social science researchers trying to find patterns usually seek out influences that may accelerate or diminish occurrences over time. Periodic economic downturns and poverty have been widely debated as related to the prevalence of hate crime in a given period. However, the problem is that unlike more readily measurable correlations, such as the link between suicides and economic recession, hate crime behavior is far more sporadically distributed. Yet, that doesn't disprove a socioeconomic correlation. The root of such behavior comes from a sense of threat. Perceived threat is a psychosocial phenomenon with great variance in how it manifests in an individual or culture. For example, at the time of writing, waves of anti-Muslim hate crimes have been occurring in the U.S. and Europe, noticeably spiking when a terror attack is blamed on Muslims by the media. The perceived threat in this case is directly related to a fear of personal harm. The media presents the image of the minority subculture as a symbol of bombing, violence, and attack. Fearful people absorb the associations and sometimes lash out vindictively, a neurotic reaction. The average person with no prior bias does not simply hear about Islamic extremism and terrorism and then suddenly choose to participate in anti-Muslim hate crimes. People have to be groomed in some way to reach such a state of susceptibility. What sociologists have found is that while the issue is complex, xenophobic and minority fears ultimately link to fear of loss, specifically loss of a community's material and social resources. These resources include jobs, health services, welfare, and other assets that are directly or indirectly economic by nature. This is not to say underlying economic factors are a sole cause, since there are many different forms of threat perceived, such as the protection of cultural identity. In sociologist Alan E. Liska's classic work, Social Threat and Social Control, the idea of group threat in the context of conflict theory is explored. He highlights the need to expand considerations away from overly simplistic ideas, such as mere group power plays. He states, "Economic interests, ethnic antagonism, and cultural identity are the new terms in the current debate. The new discussion has set aside the simplistic initial formulation of a struggle between dominant and subordinate group interests, in favor of an investigation of the implications of minority groups' threat, fear of crime, social disorganization, and competition for socio-political dominance." Fear of crime is certainly a commonly discussed threat, often talked about in media and political circles with respect to immigration. There has been no shortage of politicians and pundits who blame legal or illegal immigrants for crime and other social problems. Yet the real problem has nothing to do with minority culture and everything to do with unseen, underlying economic deprivation. For example, it has been well established that the implementation of NAFTA in the mid-1990s has had highly negative consequences for rural Mexico. Similar to the case of subsidized Western agriculture that has damaged India through globalized free trade, Mexican farming was deeply inhibited by dramatic price drops of staple exports due to competition with foreign corporations. By 1998, rural poverty stood at 82%. This poverty increased the drive for immigration to the north. In the 1990s, the Mexican-born population in the U.S. doubled from 4.5 million to 9 million. This consequence, in and of itself, has been an atrocity, not to mention the profoundly destabilizing acceleration of gang warfare and drug cartel violence that can also be linked to neoliberal economic adjustments. And Mexico is not alone. According to USAID, the lack of economic opportunities in Latin America makes the region the number one source of illegal immigration into the United States, with 88% of illegal immigrants coming from these countries. Given this, returning to the subject of fear of crime, out-group bias common to the United States and other countries, where immigrants now effectively seek refuge, proper causality must go to the impoverished condition such people have come from. Since destitution and poverty have been long correlated to general crime, this is far from a surprise. Sadly, the modern cliché, especially in the West, is that immigrants are a source of crime, and this fear is perpetuated without an understanding of the deeper root cause. Historically, this is all very old sociological behavior. Immigrants and minorities have always been used as scapegoats, even as they were being exploited and excluded. People often forget that in the early United States, vast ethnic antagonism was in play, beyond the dominant white versus black issue. The Irish, Italians, Jews, Poles, and other immigrant groups experienced deeply bigoted, xenophobic reactions as they competed for socioeconomic resources and labor. When the Irish, for example, who had been viewed as white Negroes in 19th century Britain, came to the U.S., they were ostracized for their perceived cultural traits. I can even remember my grandmother once badmouthing the Irish, revealing she was brought up in a culture of ethnic bias during her generation. The point here is that while racism and bigotry have numerous cultural roots, the meeting ground has generally been socioeconomic competition. As noted by Stanford University historian George M. Fredrickson, the 19th century was an age of emancipation, nationalism, and imperialism, all of which contributed to the growth and intensification of ideological racism in Europe and the United States. Although the emancipation of blacks from slavery and Jews from the ghettos received most of its support from religious or secular believers in an essential human equality, the consequence of these reforms was to intensify, rather than diminish, racism. Race relations became less paternalistic and more competitive. The insecurities of a burgeoning industrial capitalism created a need for scapegoats. The Darwinian emphasis on the struggle for existence and concern for the survival of the fittest was conducive to the development of a new and more credible scientific racism in an era that increasingly viewed race relations as an arena for conflict rather than as a stable hierarchy. A 2014 study by Ipsos Mori polled people in Britain who thought immigration should be reduced, asking them why. The top answer was that immigrants are taking jobs from British people, causing a job shortage. In fact, the top five answers were based on economic fears, including concerns over overcrowdedness, resource drains, and housing shortages. This factor of economic stress and the fear derived from it casts a shadow over society, with racism, bigotry, and hate crimes seeping out as a kind of negative externality resulting from a social order driven by scarcity and competition for income. While difficult to source at first glance, the economic relationships inherent in these psychological problems are ever apparent. This reality indicts capitalism distinctly, since its structural attributes of competition and advantage have normalized inequality and class. Once again, as will be argued in the next chapter, none of this is necessary. Moving on, this same undercurrent of historical and modern economic pressures and consequences are found at the root of terrorism. Terrorism has become a defining characteristic of modern times with growing media hype. From the Middle East to Europe, terrorism in the 21st century appears to have become a household awareness, sparsely but consistently peppered across the world each year. However, the popular idea that it is rooted in extreme religious thought alone or fueled by fringe ideologies is mostly a myth. This isn't to say aspects of extreme ideology are not present, but religious, national, and ideological hatreds that foment violence require more than mere words on a page. It requires insult, shame, pain, humiliation, and/or oppression. Terrorism involves an active need for retribution. This is not to absolve the problem of religion and violence, as all major theistic religions have written into their scriptures prescribed acts of revenge and bigotry to some degree or another. The issue is interpretation and motivation. People backed into a corner, feeling abused, will start to see things as a Rorschach blot, justifying ideas and acts that they otherwise would not support. Theistic religion has always been a handy tool for a rational justification of preconceived action. In the aftermath of a 2015 attack in Paris that killed 130 people, blame quickly went to an Islamic extremist group operating mostly out of Iraq and Syria called Islamic State, IS. IS has emerged as something of an upgraded version of the notorious Al-Qaeda, famously linked to the attacks of September 11, 2001. Unlike Al-Qaeda, IS has, as of the time of this writing, succeeded in taking over fairly substantial amounts of territory in post-war Iraq and beyond. The suffering and death inflicted in their wake has been complemented by self-produced media documenting and glorifying their mass murders and beheadings. Unlike crude media produced by prior groups, IS approaches these films with music, sound effects, professional editing, visual effects, and an overall Hollywood gesture. These aesthetic presentations have added to the emotional public outcry to see an end to the group, with now large sums of money being spent on military action and anti-terrorist surveillance in an attempt to collar the problem. Yet, in the midst of the panic and outrage, little perspective is given as to where IS came from. While the group is deemed a Salafist jihadist group, believing in an ultra-Orthodox Sunni Muslim interpretation and strict Sharia law, the basis of its views are not original. In fact, the dominant religion and political system of Saudi Arabia is also based on Salafist Sunni views operating under Sharia law. Saudi Arabia is also a central ally and high-value commercial partner with the United States, while IS distinctly expresses its hatred for everything U.S. and the West. So, if it is purely ideological, why such extremes? Why does the overwhelmingly vast majority of Muslims condemn such violence, disassociating from such groups? With 1.8 billion Muslims in the world, those who do commit violent acts are very few by regional comparison. A University of Berkeley study found that when it came to the context of crime, Muslim countries average 2.4 murders per annum per 100,000 people, compared to 7.5 in non-Muslim countries. This was after controlling for authoritarianism and political regime, meaning state oppression was considered not a determinant factor. Yet, it is still true that Muslims have been responsible for the majority of terrorist attacks in the world. According to political scientist M. Stephen Fish, contemporary terrorism is disproportionately Islamist. Between 1994 and 2008, the world suffered 204 high-casualty terrorist bombings. Islamists were responsible for 125, or 61% of these incidents, which accounted for 70% of all deaths. On the surface, this contrast seems strange, compounded by the fact that this rise in Islamic terrorism is fairly new, with few occurrences by comparison decades ago. The only real explanation is a social one. There is a social problem in play, arguably the result of long periods of interference coming from the Western world. A cursory examination of the Middle East region